to do.
Hey, we're back. We took a nice vacation last week, we didn't. But here we are today, this fine Tuesday. Hopefully the world hasn't ended by Tuesday because we record on Sunday. Thanks for joining us. We are Taking It Down, a pop culture podcast. I'm your host and editor-in-chief of the Alabama Take website, and joining me soon will be esteemed co-host Adam Morrow and much less esteemed co-host Donovan Reinwald. For today's podcast discussions, we've got some major segments belonging to I May Destroy You and Lovecraft Country, both of those HBO shows. We're going a bit HBO heavy today, but we've got more sprinkled throughout the show that you can see in the timestamps and in the show notes. You can help with the cost of podcasting and website hosting for us if you'd like. You can visit buymeacoffee.com/thealabamatake, all one word, and donate any amount you wish. I think it's got preset amounts of like 5 or 10 or something, but you know, I think you can change that. So that's just a cool way to help out with supporting our endeavors. Let's get the other two guys in here for some jokes and some serious LOLs.
Well, I'm surprised you didn't plug Donovan's OnlyFans there with the Buy Me a Coffee thing. I hear that's going pretty well for him.
I've been told I'm not allowed to do it anymore because it was misleading advertising.
Now I'm really interested.
Instead, you can find me on OnlyCats. posting some naughty kitty videos later today. Purring and meowing. Woof.
Wow. Oh, God. Yeah,
it's going to be bad.
And that's not a euphemism.
OnlyCats.com.
All right, I want to start with the shocking news of Chadwick Boseman's death from cancer. We all found out yesterday, but we do record on Sunday. He had stage 3 colon cancer in 2016, and then he had progressed to stage 4, I think even before this year, before 2020. Never seemed to mention it to anyone, or not many people knew about it, and he did end up making several movies during those years. Most are going to remember how stellar he was for bringing this quiet resolve to Black Panther and the Black Panther movie and the Avengers movies. But he was more than an action hero, as we found out in Spike Lee's movie, The Five Bloods, which we talked about on here a few episodes ago. And Adam, you talked about how that movie is going to look and feel much different now with that information. Did you want to comment on that?
It was an initial reaction when we found out, I guess it was Friday night, that he had passed, and thinking about the setup of that movie being that they're kind of permanently haunted by this friend, and the fact that he played him, and was that his last role? I don't know. It's always confusing about when they made a movie and when it came out, all that kind of stuff. But his most recent roles, that's, I don't know. That'll be a very haunting experience, I'd have to think, going forward.
I think we're maybe getting another Black Panther. I don't know how much of that is done. They have such weird shooting schedules for those movies.
I know that was a question, and I know that a lot of people said, nobody wants to ask that question right now, you know, because it seems like
totally.
It's a little disrespectful to say, like, well, did they shoot enough for me to get another big budget comic book movie?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I'm just floored by him and what he was able to do. I mean, he was already an unbelievable talent, and he's getting a lot of praise for the stoic nature that he faced all of this with, which is totally, I don't know, I've just been, you know, that old kind of cliche platitude of never assume you know what anybody's going through. It's pretty, to go back and watch interviews with him now, or, you know, comments, even stuff about, you know, people get obsessed about how those guys get jacked for Marvel movies and then maybe lose weight for a different one and all these kind of things. And, you know, he'd say, people would ask, oh, that must have been pretty hard. And he'd kind of laugh and say, oh, you have no idea. It's like, well, we really didn't.
Also, guy went to Howard, which is so cool, and seems like he was a good dude, and cool stories coming out. Like, you know, he got a chance to go to Oxford, or I say coming out, it's been out. He got a chance to go to Oxford for a theater program. He later found out that, like, Denzel Washington had been the person. You know, there's just a lot of cool. It feels sad, but also, like, in a good way, it's kind of good that, like, the response to this dude was, like, oh, let's celebrate. You know, like, we have so much to celebrate with his life.
And he was only 43.
Yeah.
And talk about being young. Donovan, you and I were talking off mic about the celebrities, I suppose, that would have shocked us the most, which, and you mentioned David Bowie was probably the most shocking. And this one was up there.
This one was up there. Just for David Bowie, it was because he had just released the album. And then 2 days later, he died. And then this one, here I am on a Friday night trying to watch The Thing, and in the middle of it, find out Chadwick Boseman's died, you know, and it's like, it just seemed like what? How could he be dead?
He did some pretty good work. You can only imagine how much more in depth his acting would have gone. It was headed in that direction, if not already there, pretty much. So
that's the sad thing.
You got to think he was on the cusp of being at the top of his game for two decades to come. And, you know, kind of, I guess, the luxury of being a dude who, you know, I was kind of surprised that he was well into his 40s. I guess, I don't know, the gravity that he could bring to some of those characters, that makes sense. But, I mean, it seems like a guy in Hollywood that's really starting to pick up steam, that he could have had easily 20 more years of, for the rest of his a normal quote-unquote lifetime of, I don't know, just so many of those movies and scenes wouldn't work without what he brought to them, which I know has been said ad nauseum this weekend, but, you know, I think ABC is planning on showing Black Panther tonight without commercials, and obviously we can't plug that since this won't be out until Tuesday, but that just speaks to, you know, I remember when that movie came out, watching kids reacting to seeing a superhero who looks like them for the first time. And like, that's kind of stuff that just brings a tear to your eye, when otherwise it's kind of just a goofy, Marvel can be so goofy and hit those honest moments kind of rarely. I mean, they're fun, but they hit those moments kind of rarely. And that movie and his role in the Avengers was always an exception to that to me.
Yeah, truly sad. And he would have been an Oscar winner at some point, you gotta think.
Hands down. No doubt. I mean, he'd been nominated several times already, right? Am I right in thinking that he got a nomination for Jackie?
I am not sure. Do you mean 40? Yeah.
42, yeah, sorry. Robinson. I meant Jackie Robinson. Obviously, the movie's not called that. It's called 42. but I thought he'd been nominated. Maybe I'm wrong. I just, thinking about In Da Five Bloods, I can't imagine an actor other than, I'm sure others could have, but like, he just seems so perfect in his role. And spoiler for The Five Bloods, anyone who wants to turn off now, kind of at the end when he appears in this almost like Christ-like role or forgiving role and just is like, ain't no thing. Just the way he says it and the look on his face gives me chills to think about. How do you pull something like that off? It's amazing. And you know, the as we celebrate, kind of like we've all been saying, right? Like, as we celebrate this dude who seems like he just meant so much to so many people and was great, it's such a shame that we're not going to have, you know, those 5, 6, 7 other movies out of him that are like these handful of classics where we're saying nobody else could have done that.
Mm-hmm. But it's an amazing body of work, regardless. So it's,
yeah, not to denigrate what he did do. Absolutely.
Sure. We're going to shift gears here. So, much like those school days, where you'd write about what you did last summer, I want to know what you guys did with your week off.
I honestly can't remember. Oh, I watched Lovecraft Country.
So we all went to school at the University of Alabama, though none of us live in Tuscaloosa any longer. And boys, we got a situation down there.
Oh, you mean because we're too good at partying?
That might be why. That's kind of what I want to get into real briefly. How much blame gets passed around for what's going on down there? By the way, if you haven't heard, COVID has not enrolled at UA, but is definitely hanging out at the bars down there.
COVID ain't enrolled in UA, but he's coming to class.
He's auditing a couple classes, let's put it like that.
He's a better student than some of the enrolled students, because he's at every class, and some of them like to sleep in.
Mr. Falwell Jr., he's not necessarily participating in the academic process, but he is there lurking.
Oh, man, can we talk about that? Can I talk about the time I went to Liberty?
like as a student?
No, I was there for my brother-in-law's graduation. And oh, so I went to, let me just like, this is going to get me canceled, but like the Avengers of assholes. Like it's like the biggest assholes on the planet assembled. You got your convocation. You got Jerry Falwell Jr. You got Eric Metaxas. You got Bobby Jindal. Remember him speaking at the convention? It was incredible.
I felt like the rally
at Nuremberg.
Oh, Jesus. And all you needed was, I don't know, Trump, Pence, and
well, this was a little too Bannon, right? This was a little too early for that. He hadn't burst on this. This is when Bobby Jindal might be, you know, president one day.
Oh, I remember those days. How quaint. Oh. So, speaking of the UA situation, and a little bit more, you know, the COVID outbreak down there is getting a little, it was getting unruly enough to where they were worried, to where they were saying, you know, in a week or two's time, if we keep this rate up, it's going to get ugly. I think that was the big deal, right? It wasn't so much that they were uncontrolled numbers at the moment. It was just starting to snowball.
Yeah, I mean, you just kind of run how things spread, right? Like the numbers, it's just like a probability game that you can't lose and run out of bed space. I don't know. The whole thing, the way that it's handled, I was born and grew up in Tuscaloosa and went to school there and lived there afterwards. So the transition of that place from like a, you know, a solid state school where you go if you live in the South to like, I don't know, it's just this gross kind of indulgent, like conservative fever dream or something.
Yeah, I was going to say, just say it, man. Just say it, because I'm in agreement. What is it? It has turned, from my point of view, outsider looking in, and it was getting there when I was a student in, well, we won't say what year, because I can't honestly remember. I went twice. And it was turning into this just white privilege Republican bullshit center. Even, you know, as long as I was a part of it, and now I feel like it's worse, but maybe it's not. Maybe it's the same, and I'm just an outsider now.
Well, I think that getting out-of-state kids in, while not the worst idea on paper, you would think that that would bring new ideas, fresh perspectives, all those kind of things. And it's not even necessarily, like, you know that if a school is supposed to reflect the state, if it's a state college, like, it's going to lean pretty conservative in the state of Alabama. I understand that, but the, you know, just bulldozing half of town to build condos, and you start driving around and, you know, kids are like throwing their shit out the windows all the time and like just treating it like they're like at Panama City. Yeah, it's, yeah. Like, it's like a big playground for them. It's disappointing. I mean, I know, like, from the time me and Donovan were there at the same time, from the time that we started until we graduated, I think it expanded by like 10 or 15,000 students.
Oh, yeah. Every year it was like a couple thousand more.
Yeah, like it went from like a pretty manageable 28, 29, and I know it held like between 20 and 25 for decades, but that 28, 29 all the way to almost 40, that's just too many people.
Too many 18, 19, 20-year-old people with no sense of responsibility in this.
And really no tie to the area.
Right.
No tie to the area and a lot of daddy's money kind of situations, those kinds of people.
Yeah, and I don't know. I've been hesitating to criticize that age group too much. I would like to think that I would have been more responsible.
Yeah, I get that. I was too, because I was thinking college age students. What did I do? Goodness, don't ask, right? But go on.
Well, the disappointing thing to me is, you know, you can't expect different behavior out of students if you don't take it seriously from the top down. And I mean the very top. Like, I don't want to rope our president into people not wearing masks in line at Gillette's, but the two are definitely tied together, if only because just a refusal to accept a situation and make a plan. You know, I mean, if you do that, if we just confront reality all the time, then football is starting on time. There's not crowds maybe, but you know, you can safely get a university experience while wearing a mask, all these things, but you have to at least acknowledge that reality has changed temporarily to have those things. When you just kind of like bury your head in the sand, don't know, it's to go from to seeing that happen on a major scale in Tuscaloosa. I mean, that's a big university, and now living in Florence and seeing it kind of happen here, just like, come on, y'all, we can do better than this.
It's just wild to me that bars are open at all, because we've learned so much about how this spreads, and bars are one of the worst. I mean, you can't up here right now, they're closed, and our numbers have been pretty decent. But I do think, yeah, I think Adam kind of hit the nail on the head, right? Where we kind of have the personal responsibility narrative for 18 to 22 year olds, many of who are being very responsible. But also, it's kind of like, the personal responsibility is all on you, the great college consumer, and nobody else here has any responsibility, you know? And it's just figuring out a group and then blaming everything on them is not a super constructive way to handle a problem.
Well, yeah. unless like Adam mentioned, you blame the administration, the current administration. I can't help but blame them, because if when's the last time anybody from the president's office or the vice president has mentioned COVID-19?
I heard that during the RNC, they mentioned it a bunch about how it's done.
About how well it's done, right?
About how it's going great.
Yeah, well.
You know, it's one of the great American success stories, COVID. You know, think about it. Like, COVID started out as nothing. Just nothing. Almost no resources.
Hold like and now look, bootstraps.
Look where COVID is now. I think we ought to, you know, we ought to, and COVID's creating jobs. All those people working for vaccines, they wouldn't have those jobs without COVID. COVID's a job creator.
Hard to deny. I think the most frustrating thing about this, and Blaine, we've talked about this a bit, is like the idea that if you're taking precautions, you're somehow afraid, living in fear. Yeah. All these things, it's like, you know, I'm not somehow like, I mean, it's toxic masculinity bullshit, but that's been like so hardwired into a certain fragment of the population's mind that they just can't get over. And it's like, we can disagree, that's fine, but like when it comes to the common good, I mean, even like one of Saban's comments about this, you know, he says something about like, for a society to work, you have to do X, Y, and Z. It's like, oh, he just summed up, for all you dumbasses, what a social contract is, like what living in a society is, and we just can't do it. It's frustrating.
Well, speaking of Saban, that does allow me to jump into where I was going with this in the first place, which, how excited are either of you about football and the way it's being presented to us right now? Like, the SEC won't start until late September, late next month, around this time next month. The Big Ten wants back in and wants to try to start around Thanksgiving, may or may not, still may do spring. The Pac-12's off the table until spring. And when it's like this, do we care? During a pandemic, do we care? I know the NBA's playing plenty of games. They did take a break this weekend or postpone some games, rightfully so, this weekend. So how much do we care right now? I know my personal life, I've gotten away from being maybe obsessed, maybe overwhelmed by the pandemic, though still very cautious. So what do you guys think? Is this the college football season you want? Will you watch it?
I was so pleased to see real live football that I watched a high school football game on ESPN last night. So clearly, if you told me, yeah, Donovan, you're going to be so excited to be scrolling through your cable channels and see high school football that you're going to watch it, I would have said you were nuts. But clearly, I'm not in control of my own emotions right now.
Well, that's good to hear, because this is a question I've been asking myself, these questions I've presented to you guys. How much am I going to care? Now, that Saturday when they kick off, I could tell you a whole lot more then. I was happy when I was looking at Instagram and I follow ESPN's college football account, and they had some highlights from those couple of games that aired yesterday, and they were fun to watch. One of the first plays from scrimmage, I think, for 2020 was like this guy running a 75-yard taking it from the backfield for 75 yards for a touchdown. So it was good stuff to watch. So, but how much am I going to care when my hatred for those West Coast teams isn't being fueled?
Yeah.
I do think it's going to be easier. You know, there's always been, I think we're all aware at all points in our football fandom of maybe the dissonance between who's on the field and who's in the stands. And even beyond appearance, like, And it's still, we talked about how the university is, at least in Tuscaloosa, maybe a bit more conservative, but it's still, you know, a kind of a hub of progressive ideas in the state of Alabama. And to kind of run that against maybe what college football represents to a lot of people. I mean, it's like a probably the most deeply conservative sport, I would guess. And something to love something that much that is fully kind of in the pocket of this current brand of that. I don't, not to, people say don't make everything political. Well, it is political. You know what I mean? Like, I go to a game and I'm like, most of these people are, would strongly, maybe even violently disagree with me. And that's a weird thing to think. And especially to hear the players speak up and people kind of, you know, throw digital rocks at them when they do. But to see things like Najee Harris kind of taking the initiative and saying that the whole team is going to walk with the coaches over to Foster, where the stand in the schoolhouse door happened, and where, you know, there's no practice Monday. It's not like they're like walking out on anything, any responsibility. I don't know. That gives me hope, I guess, that even if people disagree, they can listen to the players and understand where they're coming from. Because for me, it's just always, the last 4 years has been tough. And I do think I'll get back into it. Just, if we're talking purely entertainment level, yeah, I'm probably get into it. I'm not fired up about it right now, but you know, we talked about when soccer came back, like the first game, I'm still like, this is June. And I was still kind of jittery about like, should you guys be running into each other right now? Are we watching COVID spread around? But then when that kind of got, you know, we're well beyond that point of kind of what we understand is safe and not safe. But it took a few games to get back in the swing of just, Blaine, you talked about hating on West Coast teams, you know, like cheering for your team and being petty about other people. It makes you feel good. Sports are back.
I think too, you know, if we're, part of my excitement level has been like, my brain is hedging its bets on like it getting canceled, you know? So it's like, I'm not going to get all wound up for something that's like 3 weeks away that like looking at what's going on at UA right now could very well not happen.
Yeah, there's that going on in my head too. I just keep thinking, they're going to get four games deep and it'll get canceled.
That's what I'm thinking. I'm going to watch them. All four of them.
But high school football in the state of Alabama has been going on for 2 or 3 weeks now, and so
I think what I want to see them handle is like LSU has four offensive linemen right now not in quarantine. What if that happens to their, I don't know, wide receiver core the week before the Alabama game? Like, how does that?
Then I think we have a good game. Then I think we have a good chance at beating the fellas.
It's just interesting how they're going to.
Yeah.
Do all
that stuff.
Just hope it's them and not us, maybe. Well, I guess.
Yeah. I guess, yeah. Even this weekend, right? It seems like, I can't say the school name right. Austin
PA.
Thanks. Austin PA.
Isn't it?
I think it is. I don't know. Had a very possibly had a long snapper out and was having all kinds of long snapper issues. So,
I mean, maybe we should just embrace what we have and say this is part of the drama now.
It's part of the fun.
All right. So I hate to even bring this up. I really do. But we got to talk about Josh Kavanaugh.
For colon reasons?
I'm sorry, for what?
like colon reasons? Like the same reason that you talk about colon cancer? Like,
oh,
I know it's not fun, but, you know, get Josh Kavanaugh wants you to get checked.
Well, sort of. Josh was very kind and made, he visited our buymeacoffee.com/Alabama Take thing, apparently, or maybe he went to our website and clicked on shop, whatever. He was very, he apparently listens, and he apparently did make a Patreon-like supportive gesture. So I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that. So our medicine is over. We took our medicine. No, he's great, guys. For those listening and don't know,
old Josh,
Josh is a very old friend of ours here on the show, and we do like him a lot.
Sweet Josh K.
Adam, this may just be you and I talking, but I may destroy you. Wrapped. Am I able to spoil it? Are you caught up on this?
I'm ready to go. I'm fully caught up. Let's let it rip.
Well, I noticed this week you didn't respond to a text or two until much later, so I assumed you were catching up on some television.
Yeah, well, we watched a few films this week, and yeah, I might have. I got to be honest with you guys. You know, with this new Xbox Game Pass thing, I might have downloaded Halo and been playing that. There's a small chance. So I was probably acting like a 17-year-old when you texted.
There's no, you know, sometimes that frustrates me to see grown men playing video games, but at the same time, I think it's just envy. I think I just want to do that for a couple hours.
I don't know, a quick hit, you know. I'm not putting Code Red in the coffee maker or anything. Just give me 20 minutes.
What is Code Red in the coffee maker? Is that
you gotta brew up coffee?
You got to brew up some Code Red.
I've never heard of
Gamer Sesh.
You know, Mountain Dew
Code Red. You
remember that? They make a coffee. Yeah, I knew Mountain Dew Code Red, but they make coffee.
I don't know.
No, you just
actually do.
So what you do is, like, you know, your coffee maker, right? And you get your water, right? And that's Code Red. And then you get, like, your grounds, and that's Code Red too. And then you just brew it.
Then it's just fucking coffee.
No, it's Code Red. Anyway,
no, it's Code Red.
Okay,
I finished the show. Yeah, I did.
Cool. So I may destroy you. We will. We'll go into spoiler stuff then for the last two episodes. Yeah, to me, I'll tell you what I think, and I'll let you go from there. I thought it had an amazing, fantastic two episodes to end the series, but it did lag in maybe episodes 7 through 10 for me personally. And we get these moments, I suppose, where Bella, our protagonist, she encounters one of her rapists. And I'm talking about the one who pulled his condom off during sex, that guy. And he eventually helps her flesh out her nonfiction work, and he looks like he's got it into book format and helps her with that. And she's got some great ideas going, though it's a little too late because she's been fired and she owes all that money back to her publishing company. And then the last episode is like this 3-block narrative to sort of display or present how she possibly handles her original rapist that was in episode 1. Once she spots him in the bar where the crime actually happened, she's returning to the scene of the crime, as she says a couple times in the episode. And each of these, to me, represent a way of freedom from this brutal and haunting assault. I enjoyed that last episode more than any of the previous ones, maybe with the exception of the first episode, because it played with her mind and reality so well, and I haven't seen that done as blatantly as this show handled it. Like, these are 3 possible ways that I can get away from this. And when the 3 dead or ruined rapists leave at the end of the episode, they get up and leave. I felt like that was just at a powerful moment, as if to say she needed not just one mental thing to put her on the road of maybe getting better or feeling a little bit better, but it required 3 different things, or 3 major things. And, you know, you could read it as revenge, these 3 things as revenge, understanding, and love, or something along those lines, maybe, or lust or something, for that last scene with the rapist. And then it was just, I just loved how it got even weirder than it had been. And when I say weird, I mean playing with reality. What about you? What'd you think? I felt like that was an exceptional ending, and I would have liked to see more episodes kind of like that, where it was a little different, a little off kilter. What do you think?
You know, even visually, they started doing more stuff that it stayed grounded in reality. Like, even the party scenes were never like, they didn't speed the camera up or like warp things through the whole series. And then the last 2 episodes, they even started to kind of do some things that showed that either perception or whoever the narrator is kind of distorting reality a bit. And I wondered, did you take away from that last episode that she was attempting to write the end of the story, and that she was trying on all those different hats and kind of...
That's exactly the way I saw it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Each time she was trying to say, this is how it ends, because the previous episode had the guy that she had hooked up with and had raped her, you know, or sexually assaulted her, I think it may be a better term. I'm not really sure how you'd phrase it. But, you know, he helped her work out the book or see how she could organize it and talk about those things. And I think the last episode was her saying, these are the 3 possible endings and I'm going to pick one of these. And none of them were real. I didn't take that any of them really happened. It was just a
right
a matter of her mind, I think.
Well, and it's also the I remember the first episode, I kind of rolled my eyes that the bar that they go to is called Ego Death. So that I feel like that was still fully in play, that she, you know, she's obviously going through more than it's about. You know, we talked early on, this isn't going to be a whodunit kind of thing, even though that is kind of addressed. But, you know, it's also her story of growth, personal growth, going from kind of this aimless character to finally accepting some responsibility at the end, not for sexual assault or anything like that, but kind of saying, I still have to get my life in order regardless of, and it did all of those things in this such a balanced way. And even him or her accepting the guy coming over, Della, his fake name for his book.
Another Della on HBO this year.
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to sue. Della Ray is going to sue to try to get some intellectual property going on. But, you know, one of the things that he told her when he's laying out all of those, here's how you can structure, it got real meta there for a second. Here's how you can structure a narrative nonfiction piece. And one of the things that she said, or one of the things he said was, you can also do this circular thing for the ending. And then they totally did that. I mean, he like explained the last episode before they did it.
Yeah, didn't, and then you use the word meta as if it was a left a bad taste in your mouth. Did you?
No. I am here for the them telling me what they're going to do and then doing it. I love that. And it's for him to comment about, you know, introducing. He's even kind of like looking down at his shoes when he says you have to introduce the villains to the story, and like he knows that he is one. And I thought that was all so well done when the last episode started, everything kind of made sense until they're beating him to death. You know what I mean? It's like, I could kind of see all of this playing out the way that it is. And then when that happened, it just had such a, like a nightmare quality. It kind of reminded me of the, what was the other HBO show where the guy commits a crime and then at the, he's kind of like in, what was the name of that show? He's in prison the whole time. The Night Of. And it had that kind of quality of like, you just see this escalating, like you're in a dreamlike state and you know you should stop, but they can't stop. And like, it kind of had me squirming in my seat, like, guys, come on. And then before you realize, oh, this is like a device going on. I thought the whole thing was great.
It had me a little worried that it was going to involve them trying to cover up this murder and then they're setting up like a season two kind of thing, which would have felt so out of place in that show.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the most worry that I got about that was when they flashed to Terry's face and she was trying to process it. And it's like, well, now you have three people who she is going to have to decide what she's going to do in response to seeing her friends do this. Bella is doing this out of, you could call it a crime of passion in a way, I guess, or at least, you know, heavily emotional. Passion kind of implies the wrong thing, but her other friend is like, maybe more maniacal in what she's doing. And that I agree that I thought at the moment, like they're going to try to set something up here that I don't necessarily agree with for moving forward. So I was relieved when the next section started.
Yeah. And you did the do-over where she's in the,
right.
She's in the garden with her roommate.
Who's the best guy in the whole show.
Yeah, absolutely. There was nothing, you know, quote unquote, wrong. Every one of these characters had a little bit of reveal going on. Like in the next episode, you'd get something wrong with Terry or Kwame or whomever. And so you never got anything wrong with her roommate.
It well, he even watched
kind of that, interesting.
He watched that video on loneliness at the end of the next to last episode. That's how the episode ended. Like she goes out to the bar. You know, they do that scene where they're sitting there and she goes out to the bar and he watches this little video about it's okay to feel alone sometimes. Here's a way to cope with it.
That kind and there of was thing. A huge hint that he was agoraphobic and never left the apartment, right?
I think so. I mean, I know he said, well, you know, I don't really go out. But it was interesting that the conclusion was her saying, oh, I'll just stay in. Let's just do something here. As if to say, like, maybe, I don't know, maybe being a little bit more grounded isn't the worst thing. Maybe I shouldn't just go hang out at this bar every night.
Yeah.
I thought it was great. I thought I agree that it maybe they could have cut an episode or two her, but they kind of needed it for her descent into that horrible character that kind of came to its fruition on the Halloween episode. It was a good journey, I guess, that we've said it again and again every time we talk about the show. It started one way and then shifted gears, mm-hmm. and became this really sprawling, kind of all-encompassing thing.
Internally sprawling, I would even say.
Right. You get to see her try on a lot of different hats and deal with a lot of different, everything from, you know, her family's barely in it, yet the episodes where they are pretty profound. You know, you have mm-hmm. mother-daughter issues, father-daughter issues, brother issues. The two friends are really the ones that stay constant.
And I do think it was a little bit of a shame we didn't get more of a period on the end of Kwame's sentence, you know?
What do you mean by that?
He didn't even appear in the last episode.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
So,
and he, but, I think he was an interesting character too, to him trying to work through, I don't know, they were just unafraid of messiness and kind of, nobody was all good. Nobody was all mm-hmm. bad. I thought it was an impressive achievement.
I thought it was pretty good. It did let me down a little, but because when in that last episode, when it did come back to the possible revenge ending, and then it came back to the possible calling the police on the rapist, like that became engaging to me. Maybe because it had taken a swerve away from that and then came back around to it. Maybe if episode 3 or 4 had been, you know, those things where she was trying to track down her rapist or something, it wouldn't have been as enthralling. But yeah, it was a good show though. Michaela Cole written, and I don't know if they're going to do a second season, but she wrote this one. And, you know, if they do a second season, it'll be interesting where all she goes there, because this show would do some zigging when you expected it to zag, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I wondered about a second season if it would, you know, there was such an inciting incident in this one, but it wasn't, I mean, it was necessary for the action, but I feel like you get there's still a lot of meat on the bone without it, so to speak.
All right, well, let's take a break and we're going to come back and talk. We've got our Lovecraft expert. We're going to talk Lovecraft Country here with, we're going to bring Donovan back in. Let's take our break. All right, thanks for listening. We're with you each Tuesday, and we talk books, movies, lots of television, some music here and there. So subscribe to us if you haven't already, and tell a friend. Share us on social media if you want. Leave us a review on your podcast app if you can. Find us online. Let us know who you are and what you like, and hopefully we can cover some of those things. And of course, you can always help the site by visiting and clicking on shop. Let's get back into the show with our discussion about the HBO series Lovecraft Country. So, Lovecraft Country on HBO. Before this show aired, couple weeks before or a month before, I was confused on what this was on a few levels. I knew it was a book. I didn't know if it was about H.P. Lovecraft. I didn't know if it was about by him. I was really, like, I just was very barely aware in my periphery about the book. And then the show started showing commercials, or HBO started showing some commercials for this. Donovan, were you... did you have more familiarity with this? I know you haven't read the book.
I was a little bit. It's not about H.P. Lovecraft, but I was a little bit more familiar with it just because the book was on my radar, and I'd read reviews of it, and was just one of the books I was keeping my eye out if I ever saw it on a used bookstore or something.
And as it turns out, it's sort of using the real life racism of H.P. Lovecraft blended with his fantastic and horror related writing to yes. talk about racism and a few other things in America. Am I wrong? Am I reading there?
I think you pretty much got it, hit the nail on the head. Although I think this is a minor note, but I do think it was kind of cool in the series. It's still pretty radical to show black characters enjoying science fiction and being conversant with this kind of stuff. Like the main character, loves Lovecraft, loves the stories. And there's references to Ray Bradbury, and there's references to some older pulp stuff. And you're at one point, one of the books that they pull out is an old Arkham House publication of one of H.P. Lovecraft's work, which was a small print, smaller press that was kind of founded to really publish some of his stuff and some of his collaborators, and they published other things as well. So I think that there's kind of the, like, it's doing what you said, but it's also positioning its characters in a way that it's like, we are here too. And we are also part of this story. And we were always here. It's cool.
I love that.
Yeah.
I really did. It's to find that the one of the main protagonists, Atticus, Tick, as they call it,
Tick.
Nickname. Mm-hmm. To see him in the, like, second scene, opening part of the first episode, to see him having a book, a science fiction book, that somebody would have read in the 1950s that you usually associated with the ninth grade glasses wearing white kid, you know, in suburbia. But no, this was a guy coming home from the Korean War. And before we get into the episode, where I'm about to start opening the doors to episodes 1 and 2, we're only going to cover the first two, by the way. But this blew my mind, and I don't know why. I don't know. Yeah, maybe Donovan or Adam can help me unpack this. But the book was written by a guy named Matt Ruff. Is that his name? It blew my doors open to find out he was a white guy. Did you know? I mean, what's... Usually, let me put it like this, and I might want to tiptoe around this subject, but usually when a white person writes about this kind of thing, it gets discounted for not being a lived-in experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't ever remember a fuss being made about this book. So...
I wonder if it was too niche.
Yeah, maybe so.
Or because I can't remember if there were conversations happening in, like, science fiction and fantasy communities, because there has been a sort of, as with many things, a sort of years-long reckoning with actually some of the stuff that the show talks about, you know, with kind of the you know, some of these people that are lionized. For instance, you know, H.P. Lovecraft, for years, it was a bust of him that you got for the World Fantasy Award. And, you know, anyone who won got a bust of H.P. Lovecraft. And anyway, a lot of really bad behavior by a lot of fans who are clearly seem threatened by this, but I almost wonder if it was just there was so much else happening that people were like, we don't have the time, we have so many more other things to be frustrated about right now.
Right.
I don't remember hearing any kind of fuss about it.
So I guess that's in the forefront of my mind. I'm reading American Dirt by Jeanine Cummings, and that got a lot of dust up because of she's not a Latino lady, and she's writing about that experience. Mm-hmm. Anyway, let's get into the show, which, again, surprised me. It was written by the novel was written by a white man, but because the novel and the show is so deeply about race, not the only thing. So let's start dissecting it. The show opens with the very first scene is Tick in the Korean War or some war, because he's having this dream as he's riding on a bus, and it's very sci-fi. The production is stellar, and we get these weird moments of monsters coming in from into the war, and Jackie Robinson, speaking of Jackie Robinson again, comes in with a baseball bat and, like, kills one of the monsters, and then he wakes up and he's been reading some sci-fi on a bus. And that's how this begins. And what a stellar opening scene for a show. That really hooked me. Entertaining, exciting. You know, I knew this was going to be well done, and that was just proof.
Yeah, it's almost like the opening to Watchmen was, where if you kind of, I don't know, if you want to set a hook, that's a hell of a way to do it. to open with that kind of production value, that kind of statement. And you learn a lot about Tick in that one moment, I think. But, you know, everything from maybe the racial stuff, but also that his brain is dominated by the sci-fi world. And as moving ahead, you know, his willingness, even saying just in episode one, to accept the what we would call the supernatural as just fact. Mm-hmm. You know, he adapts mm-hmm. very quickly to that. He's clearly been living in the world of books and imagination for a long time. And he doesn't look like, I mean, again, this is like the most jacked dude on HBO right now. He's a soldier coming home. He doesn't look like what you would expect, you know, both racially and like, you know, you don't expect that many soldiers coming home to be like chilling out with some sci-fi. It was a hell of an opening. That all of the getting into Chicago, I thought it was all great.
Yeah, I liked pretty much the whole of the first episode. Hooked me.
The whole of the first episode, I thought was really well done from start to finish. Watchmen and Lovecraft Country both doing this excellent job, and this is why I'm so interested in the show. It does this excellent job of using a utterly fantastical narrative. In the case of Watchmen, maybe not as much, but still, with the Dr. Manhattan stuff, certainly it's fantastical in some way, or sci-fi in some way. But using that to tell about some serious thematic things, and in both cases, race for the most part. And I love that kind of stuff where you take some thing that's not real, totally fictional, but use it to talk about real world grounded issues, no matter what they are. I was the most interested in Game of Thrones when I thought it was a critique of climate change and our ignorance or inaction on climate change. That was when I really was the most interested in Game of Thrones, as far as the White Walker stuff, that is. The intrigue was certainly always present and interesting. But so Lovecraft Country is doing this where it is weaving together, you know, just entertaining, fun, childhood, Steven Spielberg-esque almost things, monsters, chase scenes, you know, survival, haunted house even kind of things there. We'll get into episode two in a second, but weaving those in with these issues that we need to be thinking about anyway. We need to be cognizant of and working on, so...
Yeah, it's so interesting how, you know, like with kind of the monsters and stuff, like there's horror, but it's almost like kind of fun horror, if that makes sense. And but then it's so cut, at least for me, my experience with watching it was, you know, the monsters were framed by this really kind of scary and souring experience with the white lawman that, you know, said this is a sundown town. You need to get the, if you're not out of here, we're going to kill you. And they're setting up a situation where they will kill him. And it's interesting how, like, I think people that really love horror can be kind of fun or playful for them. And the, like, there were parts, you know, even in the first show, in the first episode where I was giggling, because I'm like, they're throwing in this reference, or, you know, the Arkham House book, that's cool. But it really was kind of, like you said, the adventure stuff was really kind of framed by, I almost had this sour feeling in my stomach just from the, you know, the real monster is racism, you know, but it is such an interesting, it's a good friend. It worked for me, at least. And maybe that's just because, that may be because, you know, I don't live it, but it was working for me.
I mean, them trying to drive the 30-mile-an-hour speed limit to beat the sunset was scarier than any monster has been
absolutely
so far. I mean, just like the sense of dread. I mean, them like in the shootout, leaving that town, and then the car appearing. That was a great moment when the car flips over, the truck flips over the car, and the car is undamaged. You know, all of those... seeing Sundown Town said on HBO, when like I've heard that said here in the Shoals about like people mad about the Confederate flag or the Confederate monument trying to come down, or like all these different things. I mean, these are like buzzwords that still have currency to both sides, You know, people still, I mean, Coleman was like famously a sundown town for years and
years.
That
was what I was going to say. Yeah, I'd always heard Coleman. I mean, even growing up in West Alabama and not too close to Coleman, I always heard that about Coleman. It was a sundown town. So I knew what that word was when I was a kid, a young kid.
I mean, there's people that were saying we need to make this a sundown town again in response to there being protests in Florence. I mean, it's that we're not far away from that impulse and that language and that desire to just scare people, which, you know, I guess that's why that scene was so, it just felt very real. And to, like y'all are saying, to intertwine that with the more fanciful stuff. I mean, the fantasy stuff or the sci-fi stuff almost made me think structurally, Donovan, the listeners can't see this, but you have a Dalek over your shoulder right now. It kind of reminded me of Doctor Who and the speed with which the episode moved. You know, a lot of HBO shows, I'm not sure that they get from Chicago all the way to their destination in the first episode and even confront multiple monsters in the first episode.
To be honest, that would be the first season of Perry Mason.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. I know. Yeah, totally.
But it reminded me a bit of that Doctor Who attitude of like, here's our characters, here are things that we're unafraid to talk about in terms of like big ideas. And, you know, everything doesn't necessarily need an explanation. I've seen where the pace could be a problem for some, but it did not deter me at all.
I thought the pace was fantastic. In fact, that's, you know, I'm big on pacing as well. I've talked about it on the show. Usually that's the first critique I have of something is how it's paced and how long it took and blah, blah, blah. But this one was so well paced. Start to finish, episode one was gripping.
Yeah. I actually thought he slipped a little in episode two.
I agree.
Because there was a lot of... it's funny that Adam said it reminded him of Doctor Who, because as soon as he said that, I was like, I totally see that, because episode two had the problem that show will kind of have sometimes, where it's like, or Doctor Who, some of the seasons will suffer from, where they want to get to their big idea, their big scene, whatever, and they kind of want to get character from point A to point B. But they don't necessarily want to show their work in between. So I did feel like episode two suffered a little bit, where it's just like, oh, stuff is just happening now, you know, and characters kind of like, and that must be where they're holding my dad. And it's like, you added one and one and came up with 1 million, you know, and it's like, it works obviously for the plot, but I felt like it was just, okay, things are happening because they have to happen to get to the beats that we want. So it's a plus and a minus in some things, I think.
I agree with that. And episode two, to me, I hinted at this earlier, that it kind of turned into a haunted house episode mixed with, how would I call it? A mix of Frankenstein almost in this attempt at immortality by the cult there at the mansion. So it, you know, some people are going to have problems with this show because it shifts tonally a little bit here and there, but it's still so exciting and new and kind of fresh and different for me.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think there were moments for sure where me and Natalie looked at each other and said, is this show good? But then like, by the end of the episode, it's like, I don't care I'm enjoying it so much. And I do think it's good. That was the answer. But there were definitely moments, beats, where we kind of thought, where are they going with this? And I think maybe it'll be, especially for an HBO audience, as the, you know, stories are going to keep shifting. I assume we're going back to Chicago. Other characters are going to come back into the fold. You know, when they got to the point that they were doing the ceremony to try to get back to the garden, you know, I thought, okay, we're doing it. This is end of episode two. This part of this journey will be over.
Yeah.
Which was, it's different. And I hope that people can go there with, I'm definitely willing to trust the writers on this and go there, but it's going to move around a lot and it'll be interesting. Is this an 8 or a 10 episode thing?
It's 8. So it's going to be a short season, 8 episodes. Yeah.
I wonder if it'll stick to like a 2 episode story arc kind of thing, or if it's going to move around.
I have no idea. It has seemed a little bit like a throwback to say something like the X-Files, you know, where you had kind of the story. I mean, I'm basing this off of 2 episodes, so I'm probably, and a preview I've seen for a third, so I'm probably wrong. But it does seem a little bit more like you've got the story, you've got the characters, they're all kind of moving towards a grander point, but there's the kind of smaller things happening in the more episodic, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Almost Bad Wolf was painted on the side of the wall, you know?
Yeah.
Could feel like that by the end of the season. I definitely think it'll be able to make a cohesive season-long statement, even though it's moving around a lot. And I got to say, do we think the uncle is actually gone?
Man, I hope not.
I hope not either, because that's Courtney Vance.
He's so good. You know,
we could do a little spoilery kind of stuff and say that, I'll pump the brakes, unless you guys just want me to say something.
No, that's spoiler.
Okay, well, all right. Spoiler for everyone. Skip 15 seconds ahead if you don't want to know this. He's scheduled to be in all 8 episodes.
Oh, okay, so. Good.
Oh, thank God.
I'm just looking at IMDb.
So. I was hoping he's not actually gone. But, do we like that his dad's Omar? I didn't. I've been trying to
I want to talk about that.
When Omar showed up, I thought the Whiteys at the mansion do not know what's about to happen to him.
He is so excited. Michael K. Williams is so fun to see pop up. Isn't he great? Anything. Did you guys notice that he and his son, Tick, of course, we've talked about Tick, but did you notice they were very similarly dressed?
Yes.
And what do we make of that?
I just thought it was visually signaling that these characters are paired right now, and you should pay attention to that.
And also that Tick really doesn't change. Like, he's got the same shirt on, I think, from...
He was in the army!
he's kind of got the Fred Flintstone thing going on, where he opens the closet and they're all yellow shirts.
I mean, the thing that I've actually really... I think, you know, Adam kind of brought this up, but in a lot of ways, like, Tick is kind of a square or a nerd, right? Like, he always kind of dresses the same, and like he's got his glasses, right? I mean, like, not really, but I've been kind of really liking that, because it's like he's a pretty cool action hero, but he's also like he's kind of a dork too.
Do you feel seen?
Yeah, incredibly seen.
Jonathan Finally, Majors. Someone on screen to represent Donovan.
Well, Jonathan Majors, it's hard to call him, I guess, a geek or a dork or whatever you want to say. He is way too in shape and manly, probably, to be labeled as such.
I just keep thinking that, just kind of with the, like, how much I loved the shot in The Five Bloods, where they kind of introduce him and he's just kind of sitting there meekly in his Howard sweatshirt.
Right.
They're yelling at him. I just keep thinking of that this whole show. He's awesome, by the way, I should say.
Yeah, he's having a great year.
The actors have all been really good. I don't know the woman who's playing Letitia Lewis. I don't know her as well. I guess she was in that Harley Quinn movie, but I have not seen that. She was
also in the movie with Denzel Washington, The Great Debaters. That's really the first time I've seen her.
I haven't seen that either. I'm not as familiar with her, and I'm liking her quite a lot.
Yeah, well, in that movie, I thought she was doing a lot of overacting, but here I am. She's one of my favorite characters. She's awesome.
Yeah,
she's great. I thought they all got a chance to shine. You know, it's almost kind of reflective of the "I May Destroy You" thing when she's kind of acting out all these different scenarios and reactions. But when they're all in their individual rooms and are confronted with, for the entertainment of the guest, that horror sequence, they all really got a chance to shine there. That was a lot of fun.
Oh man, that was
yeah. So this show apparently
queasy shot for me. That was great.
This show is apparently going to do a little zigging and zagging itself, right? Mm-hmm. And now that we know that going forward, I think that one of the things we can really relish is something that Matt Zoller-Seitz, critic Matt Zoller-Seitz, wrote. This is what some people would call a, quote, rich text. You know, literary people would call a rich text, because it feels as though it has so many places you could add footnotes and then follow up on.
Yeah.
And Donovan, you've mentioned a couple already with the book on the shelf and all those, those meta kind of things.
Just a lot of some of that stuff, that putting it in very firmly in conversation with some of these guys are pulp writers. Some of them aren't, you know, I mean, but the kind of pulp science fiction, and not only that, but just having Tick and his uncle really kind of being conversant. And they're not told, you know, they're not like the naives dropped into the horror movie. You know what I mean?
They're fluent. They're fluent in the language.
They know the language. Yeah, exactly. Right. Cause it's like they know the genre that they're in. They figure it out. And that's been kind of cool, you know. I mean, it is a little bit like, I was reminded a little bit of, you know, like in Stranger Things, right? Where the kids are like, oh, it's just like Dungeons and Dragons. Like, it almost felt like they were doing that a little bit.
Yeah, it did.
Does, if that makes sense.
I gotcha. So I think we're, to summarize, where we all feel and what we think is very entertaining and worth the ride and could be great or could just be good, right? Is that kind of where we are?
Could just be good. Yeah.
Could just be good, but entertaining. So
we'll see.
Another one of those things that we're happy to see every Sunday.
It's a good hang so far.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Well, we may chime in on Lovecraft Country maybe toward the middle or end of the series. Oh, I do want to say one quick thing that I'm so happy that the show managed to deepen with the inclusion of James Baldwin in the first episode and Gil Scott Heron in the second episode. Gil Scott Heron's probably one of my top three poets. And I just loved hearing their voices anachronistically, I suppose. Well, definitely anachronistically, because this is in the 50s and they would have been writing after that for the most part. What a joy to hear that. It kind of, and then they used the title of the Gil Scott Heron poem, Whitey's on the Moon, as the title of episode 2, which was fantastic.
Everything was great except for the Marilyn Manson, which was weird.
You think so?
I do. But, well, mostly, I think that was just me coming out of myself going, remember when this guy was the scariest thing we could imagine?
Well, yeah, I think that's what they were trying to do.
What a nerd.
All right. Well, that's it for this episode, and we do appreciate you tuning in. We had fun talking about Lovecraft Country. I'm sure we'll come back around to Lovecraft Country, talk about it. We hope you join us for even more down the road. So click on subscribe, and you won't miss us. Okay. See you next time.